This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
In your town, your suburb.
This is where the conversation begins. From Wodonga to Sorrento.
From Portland to Corryong.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. This is the Conversation Hour.
Ah, yes. The sound that echoes every suburban neighbourhood on a Sunday afternoon. We love a lawn, don't we? From our backyards to our nature strips, medium strips, parks, recreation reserves, you name it. That expanse of green space has such a special place in most of our hearts. There are even Facebook groups and podcasts dedicated to lawn porn. But is your beloved lawn doing more harm than good? All of that mowing, fertilising, watering, is it having an environmental impact? And if you think that it is, it might be part of the reason why there is a growing number of people who are downsizing their lawns or ripping them out completely and planting native gardens instead. Good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt, your co-host this morning. Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from our ABC studio in Wodonga. Bron, I'm not sure if weeds are native, but
I love to grow in my yard.
I have a lot of those. I'm not sure what sort of biodiversity that's bringing.
Well, an unwanted one, but hey, you take what you get, don't you? People are really loving this lawn-free life, and you're right, it's a growing movement. I love a good lawn, Rish, I will admit it, and mowing is kind of like meditation for me.
Really?
I put those earmuffs on and I get on the mower and, you know, it's zen, yeah, for me. But more and more people are letting go of that sort of dedication to lawn and choosing native species instead, and then seeing the wildlife, the birds, the lizards, the bees, just come back to their garden.
There's nothing like walking past somebody's lawn and then pointing out, ooh, that's a sharp edge. Look at that. Look how neat that particular lawn is. Because there's something about lawns that we do love. But you're right, more and more of us are ditching the so-called traditional lawn in favour of something more environmentally friendly. And if this is something that you've done, what's the result? What have you seen? How has your little patch had an impact on the greater biodiversity of your neighbourhood?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you in Melbourne. Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from ABC Wodonga. Are you rethinking what's going into your little green patch? Or maybe you have a larger patch like yourself, Bron. If you're out in the regions, a lawnmower is something that you hop on. You know, it's a
That's
ride.
That's right.
That's a ride
it's
on.
It's a vehicle.
It's a vehicle, absolutely, that you need a license for. But that idea of understanding what we're planting and what we're attracting. And you are seeing a shift, I think, away from those traditional English-style gardens, because I think once upon a time growing up, the fancier the lawn, the fancier the garden, the more prestige that was, you know, that was kind of added to your family.
And I think living through the millennium drought, a lot of us realised, look, this isn't sustainable. Like this really doesn't make sense for where we live. So people started to say, well, what else could go in this spot? What else could I do with my little patch? And I think the momentum has grown. And now lots of people are saying, you know what? I ripped out my lawn and I put some native species in instead, or a productive garden instead. And wow, the difference it made was spectacular.
This text from Anthony, it says, please leave our lawns alone. Nothing against helping the environment, but please don't take our lawns away. But do we need to rethink what a lawn means? Joining you in the studio this hour, Dr. Jock Gilbert. He's a landscape architect and lecturer at RMIT. And I guess you could call yourself a lawn expert, Jock.
Thanks, Rochelle. I think that might be a step too far, but I'm interested in the idea of the lawn, actually, and the lawn from, I guess, from a cultural perspective. So we've got the environment and we've got those kind of social parts of it. And so you were talking in your introduction about, you know, the what and the how, and my interest is in the why. In order to kind of explore that a little bit further, we probably need to go back in time. And I always like to start as far back as we can just by acknowledging that I live and work on the lands, unceded lands of the Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung peoples, and I've journeyed down today from the lands of the Woiwurrung people. And, you know, we were talking earlier about the seasons and how they've changed and how we recognise those and what a beautiful day it is. And it's more like an early autumn kind of patch that we're in. It's really, really beautiful. So paying respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who might be listening today and particularly to their elders and ancestors, both emerging and present. And that's that'll become quite important, I think, as we go through the conversation today. But if we jump forward, you know, probably 65,000 years and think about where the idea of the lawn came from. And for us as landscape architects, we understand that our profession is very bound up. You know, there's a guy in England who practiced probably, you know, one of the first practitioners of landscape architecture called Capability Brown in the late 1600s. And he moved landscape away from that sort of classical regimented French European style to what he called the beautiful. And the beautiful was acres and acres and acres of rolling South England lawn, basically. So the estates, the landed gentry. And that's where I think what you're alluding to, you know, it there was a sense that the higher your social standing,
yes,
the better that could be expressed through the perfection of the lawn. And then we see that start to come through in the great democracy project that rolled through England and then through America later on, where the front lawn, and particularly in America, you know, no fences, so the lawn became that kind of common space, the front lawn. And at the same time in England, the public parks movement was on. And so those of us who, you know, were probably of lesser standing then went to the park to learn how to behave and have good manners, to know when to stand on the lawn, when not to.
I would never think of lawns and good manners
going together.
Absolutely, but I sort of want to pull apart today, I guess, the changes and the difference between the idea of what a garden or lawn looks like as opposed to what it does. And there's a very big difference in something that looks pretty and then something that has a role to play. And I wonder if that's where we've seen changes as well. Let's have a quick chat to Rob, who's in beautiful part of Gippsland in Foster. Hi, Rob.
Oh, hi. How are you going?
Really well. What's your lawn like when I say lawn, I mean garden. What's it like there where you are?
Well, we've got a really nice mixed garden of natives and introduced species. But my lawn, which is not perfectly flat, it's sort of got lumps and bumps in it. But the thing is, it's not an environmental desert. I quite often watch at least four species of birds come through at various times of the day, magpies, parrots, wrens and so on, and they feed off of my lawn. So they're getting grubs, insects, seeds, roots and so on. And they do this right throughout the year. So I'm quite happy to keep my lawn as it is. And I use a battery-powered mower.
So, oh, well done.
You know, yeah. So I don't think I'm going to be turning my lawn into something else in the short term anyway.
Yeah, it's a balancing act, Rob, for you. And there's a text, Rochelle, that's very similar. It says, my magpies and kookaburras love the lawn. I've got native borders, so everybody wins. So this idea that you kind of mix it up and not just have a monoculture in your backyard, Jock, is that something that's changing the way that we approach gardens?
You know, I think the understanding of that, Bron, and I think they're really good points that have come through from the text and the caller. that it is the idea of the monoculture and the idea of lumps and bumps. Does it need to be, you know, dead smooth? Can we introduce a little bit of topography? Because as soon as we do that, then some parts of the lawn catch a little bit more water than others. We start to get dry bits and we start to get moist bits, and that increases the level of biodiversity because different little critters live in different little places. So I think I love a lawn, and I agree that there's something I'm not quite sure that it's zen, but there's something meditative about mowing the lawn. And, you know, if your lawn's big enough, you can cancel your gym subscription. But there is the very real danger that lawn does become that monoculture. And it's not, I suppose, specifically one species necessarily, but it does reduce the diversity. And so if we can work against that as much as we possibly can, so that idea of fringing a lawn or letting natives grow into the lawn, I think is really interesting. And using different lawn, thinking about different lawn grasses, because those our little finches and, you know, lots of little birds that come in will eat grass seed rather than pollen. They're not all pollen eaters.
Does it make a difference to all of, no matter how small our little patches, if we think about, and, you know, when talking about our First Nations people and their relationship, I mean, they consider themselves to be custodians of the land, that, you know, there is a level of responsibility there. If we've just got a tiny little patch, like I had a little patch of grass that was so small, I used one of those push mowers, right? Like you'd see on the cartoons, that's how small it was, but it gave me so much happiness. Does my little patch make a difference in the bigger picture?
I reckon it does, and I think that's a really great great way of thinking about the relationship of First Nations people and their knowledges to the environment. And that word responsibility is key to that. So how are we able to respond? And I guess one thing that we've got to understand is that those, you know, if we now then go into bigger themes of kind of sovereignty and land, part of land and the way that First Nations people think about land is that it's not separable from water, from trees, from plants, from the microorganisms. Every single thing is connected. And so we have a responsibility to respond to that connection and all of those relationships. Now, if we can do that to a little patch of lawn, then I think
where do we get that knowledge, right? Is the average person working at Bunnings going to be able to help you with that? Because that's where most of us are potentially getting our plants and our lawn from.
Let's head to Kathy, who's at Northcote. Thanks for calling in, Kathy.
Good morning, everybody there. I'm interested in a research that Monash University has published recently in the Age newspaper, wherein they investigated the impact of these fake plastic lawns and what they do to suffocate all of the worms and microorganisms, but also in the heat of summer, the toxic fumes that they give off, and how they also contribute, if they're located close to the house, to the house being hotter than it would normally be.
Yes,
should it be a grass
they're
lawn.
Hot. I had no idea how hot they were until we were on holidays over summer, and we were lucky enough to stay at a place where there was a pool and there was some fake grass. It was like hot concrete, you know, where you're like, sort of jumping and maybe get in the pool real quick, let's just say that. Fake lawn, I'm thinking you're not going to be a fan, Jock, but what do you think?
Correct. And it's kind of weird that they make it green, isn't it? And that goes back to our kind of cultural training that green is good and that we are, you know, enacting some sort of kind of social standing through the lawn. I reckon that one of the things that a lawn does very beautifully is reduce temperatures. So if we think about water operates on large water cycles, you know, catchment, but then there's also the small water cycle. And when we put water onto a lawn, it evaporates, but that helps to cool down our environment, you know, in our immediate surroundings. So there is something really beautiful about the relationship between the human body and a patch of lawn. There's no question that transcends all of those cultural and social kind of issues.
Is Kathy right? Like, if you imagine, it's almost like putting down carpet, right? And there are little critters and little insects and bits and bobs that are living in the soil.
Kills everything.
It does kill everything.
And it takes the oxygen. Oxygen's a really important component of soil. It deoxygenates soil so that none of those little critters can live in there. And I think also fake grass is, you know, it's a plastic. It's a product of the petrochemical industry, and I think we're going to find that it will remain in the ecosystem long after we've taken it up. You know, we can't just mulch it and turn it into new plants next year.
This, I ripped up our backyard lawn, replaced it with natives and railway sleepers. It's not perfect, which makes it just so. We had lawn, but it was dry and it turned to dust and turned into a dust bowl, thanks to my dog. Love a lawn to lie on, but it's just not suitable. So are you thinking outside the square? Are you thinking about what is native to your local patch? And what are you ripping out and what are you putting in?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Bronwyn O'Shea with you as we look at how we're replacing our lawns to make them more biodiverse. Dr. Jock Gilbert is with you, a landscape architect and lecturer at RMIT. And let's go to Sarah Reed now, who has taken this to the next level. Sarah lives in Canberra, has pretty much transformed her traditional front yard. It was quite dry, Sarah, looking at the images. And you've now, well, I called it a little garden Disneyland in Canberra. Talk us through what you did around 6 years ago.
I love that description. I think I'm going to call it that myself. About 6 years ago, we had, like some of your callers, a terrible, dry, dusty front lawn that was full of cooch and really didn't offer much joy at all. So I'm not an accomplished gardener by any stretch, but enthusiastic and a very, very keen composter. So I laid down some cardboard and put down some compost and just had a bit of a go, took a small patch of the lawn and then started to plant things and just saw that things started to take off. And from there, covered the whole of the front yard. And from there, it's just gotten better and better and better.
So where did you go to kind of get that knowledge, Sarah, knowing what to put where and what was native to your part of the world?
Look, I did a few things. Again, not by training, but I'm the interwebs is a fantastic source of information. We have fabulous park care and land care groups here in Canberra, so I'd participated in some of those, had read, and then also just good old trial and error too. So I wasn't too worried about doing the right thing, but it was really an experimental undertaking, I guess.
And what's the difference when you look out at your yard now? What does it look like compared to what it was before?
Oh, it's just no comparison. I'm staring at it at the moment and I just feel my heart filled with joy because there's always something different to look at. When I was first starting to speak to people about this and was interviewed for an article, I spoke about how I have a conversation with my front yard and it really didn't say, which makes me sound terribly unhinged and makes my husband laugh uproariously. but when it was dry and coochy and crackly, it really never spoke back to me. And now it sings to me. When I look out, I can see bugs and bees and birds and different plants thriving and some not thriving. So there's always a conversation to be had about what can I do with this patch and what sits better over here.
How differently do you use your home and your space now, Sarah? Because there's the text here that says, so where are the kids going to play? So whether you have children or not, does it determine how you use your backyard or your front yard?
Yeah, it's such a good point. And it's one, so I do have kids, but they're teenagers. So wherever there's a social media device is where they'll be. So they're at the age where gardens sadly have become irrelevant. So before it really, it's in the front. We have a dog, but, you know, in Canberra we have hedges but not fences, so I wouldn't let her at the front anyway. And the kids, it's not somewhere anyone wanted to be. The grass itself was no fun and it was too hot. It was north-facing, so it didn't lend itself well to that anyway. They're both keen sports players, so they have places they go to play sport. What I've found is when grandchildren come to visit now, or people with kids, the kids are fascinated. There's so many different nooks and crannies. There's a pond for them to dip their feet into. So it's a real feature point for people's kids because they find it interesting the way adults find it interesting.
Sarah, do you ever get that little, oh, it'd be nice to have a little patch of grass to lie on? Have you ever had any kind of regret about it?
Rien. I have not a single regret. not in the slightest. Every time I see a butterfly or a bird or a bee, It's much more functional. We spend a lot more time in it the way it is now.
Oh, well, it looks gorgeous. And people can jump onto the ABC's website to have a look at the before. And I love a good before and after shot as well. So it just ticked all the boxes for me. Sarah Reed, congratulations. I think there would be lots of people in your local area that would be inspired in order to do the same. Thanks for your time this morning.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Jock Gilbert is with you as well, landscape architect and lecturer from RMIT. Lots of people, Jock, talking about how they've done a similar thing and how it's just changed their lives. Lee is in Epping and says, we started our garden from scratch 30 years ago. No front lawn or nature strips, a very small patch of grass, not lawn though, in the backyard. Our gardens and nature strips are planted with a variety of native trees and shrubs and grasses. We've been rewarded with visits from birds, lizards, frogs and insects over the years. I'd never have lawn again. Is there a shift at the moment when we start to recognise our impact as individuals on climate change, that we all have a role to play? Are you noticing a shift?
Yeah, look, I think that's a great example. Thanks, Rochelle. And there's definitely a shift. And I think that the shift is being pushed along by individuals, and you know, Sarah's description of her her garden is just amazing. It's beautiful, and what that does then to the family and to herself, and you know, well-being. And I think the shift is becoming more apparent when it starts to be, I suppose, scale up, if you like. So when more and more people start to express these ideas, start to implement them, start to do them. So I think one, you know, the very obvious way to learn how to do a garden is to do a garden. And the, I think
you learn, you know, pretty quickly, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And that idea that the garden speaks back to you is absolutely spot on, because it does. You have it. You do enter into a conversation with it, and that, you know, that kind of strengthens the relationship. So, you know, as conversation is important to any relationship, that's just how it works. There's a project and a kind of larger project that is worth calling out here, which I think is also emblematic of the way that shift in thinking is coming through. And that's Emma Cutting's Heart Gardening Project, which you might have heard of in the kind of inner southern suburbs of Melbourne, where Emma is really focusing on, and it came out of a frustration with her local council and their inability to conceptualise what it would be like to remove lawn from a nature strip and plant some bee pollinating plants, not necessarily slavishly native, but understanding how she could improve biodiversity, how to improve the look of it and reduce maintenance. So Emma's got this amazing project now that's really getting some legs. It really runs from Westgate Park, which is another amazing biodiversity project, up to the gates of and including the Botanic Gardens. Wow. All through as a big strip through there. And it's encouraging community and community members to come together through the gardening of some of these leftover and not so much.
I love that. And the idea of cuttings, like my nan, like when we think about the older generations, because I don't know if you've been to a garden centre lately, they're not always
so
cheap.
So expensive.
It's so expensive. But the days of just saying, here, take a cutting. I mean, I love that.
A friend
idea.
Came over on the weekend and she just had a whole lot of cuttings from her garden and things she dug up that she didn't want anymore. And it's like the best present ever, isn't it? Jock, a question here from Jenny in Hawthorne East. She says, what about the important part that grass plays in carbon sequestration, erosion control and reduction of the urban heat effect? So I guess if we all start to take out our lawn and put natives in, what impact does that have on those aspects?
Yeah, look, it's a really important point, and it's a great point to raise. But I don't really necessarily think that that you lose any of the advantages of the lawn by treating it differently. And in fact, we actually get some added benefits. And the I suppose one of those added benefits immediately is that kind of notion of biodiversity. So we increase the number of the small things that can live. Mm. And sometimes those small things, I used to be able to quote this figure and I can't anymore, but there's something like 100 million microorganisms live in a teaspoon of soil. So if we cover that soil with fake grass, that's 100 million times however many teaspoons that we've lost immediately. And if we cover it just with lawn, and I think lawn does have its benefits, and particularly around those ideas of reducing urban heat island effect and increasing that small water cycle, which starts to humidify and starts to create changes and really beautiful living environments. But other treatments can also do that and have greater mm. benefits. And certainly carbon sequestration in woody plants is a far greater has a far greater potential rather than just all herbaceous. And there's a garden movement that's come out of Europe actually called the woody perennial lawn, if you like, and it's a kind of movement that allows for woody perennials to grow in herbaceous perennials and take the place of the lawn, actually.
And I could imagine it would still cool the space.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Luke's in Frankston. Morning, Luke.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to have a chat about the value of wallaby grass in creating lawns. I mean, we have this huge asset already in Melbourne, and we're like the home of grassy woodlands, and there's just a huge variety of different wallaby grasses that can really successfully be used for lawns. If people are absolutely desperate to still have a lawn, but also really interested in local indigenous planting, then I'd really encourage people to do what we've done at home.
Do some research into those. So can you talk us through what wallaby lawns grasses are?
Yeah, they are a native grass, that's correct. And there's several different species of native grass that make alternatives, if you like, to lawn. So they're a little bit rougher and a little bit coarser and a little bit often clumpy. Wallaby grass, not so much. But one of the absolute joys is to, as a Victorian, to go out to some of the remnant bits of grassland, and the previous caller is correct. We have still, we're a city built on grasslands, and to see some of those remnant grasslands in late autumn, particularly the kangaroo grasses, perhaps rather than the wallaby grasses, in that late afternoon sun, moving in the breeze, the purples, the reds, it's just a joy to behold. Organ Pipes National Park is amazing. There's other parts in the west of Melbourne. But that's very correct. And then we do then get into a discussion about the applicability of those and what are some of the other kind of needs that we have. And, we do live in a very altered urban environment. And so I don't think it's useful for us to start to think about returning to some sort of idea of kind of nature that existed prior to lawns. But having said that, I do agree that there are particular native grass species that are very applicable to those spaces that we now call lawns.
Speaking of lawn alternatives, Feralise in Ararat has sent a text saying we have a native grass lawn. Griffin weeping grass requires less water and low maintenance. And a great tip from Anne in Brunswick, who says Brunswick Communities for Nature, or BC4N, grows and sells indigenous plants cheaply. Sales advertised on Facebook every 3 months or so, especially in autumn and spring. We are talking about the growing movement of people ripping up their lawns, or part of, and instead replacing it with native species to bring back more biodiversity into their yard and their neighbourhood.
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you in Melbourne. Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from ABC Wodonga. And in the studio, Dr. Jock Gilbert. He's a landscape architect and lecturer from RMIT. As we talk about the idea of maybe ripping up your lawn or a lot of it and thinking about biodiversity, more natives, the changes that you see to your garden and to the biodiversity of your garden. Pauline's in Ocean Grove. She says, this discussion sounds like a replay of discussions I had in the 70s. Haven't had much lawn since then, having lived through severe drought in the early 2000s. It showed how different plants respond to different climatic conditions. The fashion for extensive paving and fake grass worries me far more, though, than real lawn. Well, Damon Gay is a filmmaker. He created the award-winning feature documentary 2040. Damon, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. I guess leaning into Pauline's text just then, and she's lived through drought and she's seen how different plants respond to different climate conditions. When you look forward to 2040, what role do we all have to play in our own little patch of grass, do you think?
Well, it's creating, I think it's about prioritising life. I think done up until now is kind of denuded life, and I'd include lawns in that, is that we've just created these monocultures everywhere. So I hope that by 2040 we are valuing life in a different way, and we're teaching our children about the importance of biodiversity and how you can have that in your own front yard, and that they're able to name the tree they walk past as they leave the house every day. They can name the birds that wake them up every morning instead of the disconnection we have now. And I think that would go a long way to not just improving and climate-proofing our own neighbourhoods, but it's a deeper level. It's creating that value shift in us actually taking nature seriously and embedding it into our economic systems or how we talk about these things. I think they can have a huge cascading effect from just connecting to nature in your own small way. And I've done that with my own daughters. We've created a pollinator garden in our balcony, and just to see how it's changed their language around butterflies and bees and their knowledge. And so what that looks like 20, 30 years from now, I don't know, but I think that's arguably the most important thing we can do when we do hyper-localise our own connection to nature.
Yeah, my son was given binoculars for his 7th birthday a few months ago, and so we love sitting out in the backyard and looking and seeing which birds we can see in the binoculars. It's so fun, isn't it? And yeah. Damon, you touch on something which there's a text about, which says schools and kindies need to get, well, they say lawn, but I think really garden, back into their areas. They're also afraid of anaphylaxis and bee stings, but it's insane. Awful plastic-based ground covers for the softness under playgrounds and fake grass because it looks even. It's time to get back to nature at younger ages, says that text.
Yeah, there's actually we're doing a project at the moment with a group, this great initiative down at Bowen Heads. They've got a project called Farm My School, where their principal was able to give them one of the soccer pitches, and they've planted a fully functioning farm in there. And a couple of regenerative farmers have come in there, and the kids are, as part of the curriculum, learning about soil and the microbes, how plants grow, and then they take home each day a box of fresh veggies to the parents in the pickup. So. And just already the effects on mental health there, on the kids feeling like they're part of something, it's just brought huge benefits to their school group just from embedding.
Yeah, it's been incredible, that project, hasn't it? I think it's had a real impact. Would you like to see more of that? I mean, I know that you've been a part of a hub that's just been launched to try and inspire people to, I guess, find their own solutions and their own food solutions. Does government, does education play a really big role here?
I think we all know, I would argue it's the most important thing. I think so much of our generation and older have locked in those particular values. We've been so separate and superior to nature for so long that really our only hope, I think, is to instill it in our children and change those values at that young age. And it starts with school. How do we get them to understand the importance of the living world again? Because they have been so detached from it. And especially at a time now where they're being bombarded with this artificial intelligence, which we have this natural intelligence that's been honed for billions of years, it's right there that we're not accessing. And if we don't access it, we're just going to fly off the cliff, as we all know. So how do we find ways to, you know, make teachers, parents, they are the frontline soldiers of this change we need. So how do we arm them with the right materials that they can be teaching to children so they do change their values as they grow older?
Interesting points, and a couple of people are making this on the text line, Damon, about the built environment. So this text says, stop building houses that cover the entire area of your property.
Yes.
Just have a garden. And another here says, we live in dense housing. There's not enough light between the house and the fence to grow much at all. And after years and years of trial and error, I've installed fake grass, says this text. I never thought I'd do it. So I wonder about that responsibility when we think about urban planning. Building design, yes.
Yeah, well, that comes back to what we talked earlier about the whole values. When we have created an entire system that is separate and superior to nature, we don't value nature in our design, in our tech. All the things we develop are separate and removed from it. And so we build these impossible houses that people can't live in with no access to light. So unless we shift things at a deeper level and then we think about the living world as we are creating these designs, we're not going to get anywhere. So we can keep tinkering around the edges, but really we have to address the fundamental core of what we've built here. And we have, I would say, built an entire civilization on the fact of this story that we are separate from the living world. And unless we embed it again back into this system, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing. So as you know, as your listeners know, there are extraordinary things going on around the world, like people taking action into their own hands, trying to bring life back to their own communities in whatever way they can. So that gives me enormous hope, as I'm sure a lot of people are listening.
But, and then when we look at the next generation coming through, and their deeper understanding and awareness of climate and climate change, then, you know, we're in good hands, hopefully, with the next generation. Damon, thank you so much for your time and your insights and for your incredible documentary as well. It's called 2040. Damon Gamo, filmmaker there. Also joining you in the studio, Dr. Jock Gilbert, landscape architect and lecturer at RMIT. You live in regional Victoria at the moment, but you've lived in multiple parts of the world, Jock, including here in the heart of the CBD and parts of Europe. Where's doing it well? When we look at high-density living, like that text just said, yes, we're pushing out and our peri-urban areas are getting eaten up. But when you look at apartment living and smaller living in Europe, in Asia, the biodiversity, the patch of grass, the individual responsibility, is this a global shift?
I think if we just go back to Damon's point, which was really well made and great about human beings' relationship to life and the living world and living systems and the need to shift the values around that. I think in other parts of the world we do see those values expressed differently, if you like. And I think one of the earlier callers talked about the fact that the native garden may no longer look nice, but it does different things.
I think it looks beautiful, I have to say.
Exactly. But we also have to understand that in the living world, things live and die. You know, death is part of the living world. And so not everything looks fantastic all at once. And so things change. There is registration of seasons. I mean, one thing a lawn does is very often not register a season. So there's no change. It's always green and perfect. And if we can build diversity in, we do have to accept that there is that kind of bit of messiness in our relationship. I think, I mean, this is probably a longer conversation, but for me, nature is itself part of the problem, because in other cultures, the word nature doesn't exist. So there is no difference between. So, you know, as Damon said, this idea that we can dominate something that we call nature is built in to the concept of nature. So
human beings have created that hierarchy.
It's just a concept. It's an idea. It's this thing to describe the external world. So if we have a different and messy relationship to it, there are countless other cultures that we can draw upon. And, you know, it's an absolute conceit to think that as non-Indigenous people, we've been here for 250 years, we brought these ideas of nature and landscape, and I'm a landscape architect, into this country, when we already know that pre-existing that for tens of thousands and possibly hundreds of thousands of years, there's a way of thinking about the world that's external to us, the living world and the non-living world, that performs beautifully. And that is the idea of country. And so how do we have a relationship to that? And I think, because the other point that Damon made, which was fantastic, used the term hyperlocalism. And so none of this can be rolled out in kind of generic terms. It is utterly local, to the point where the previous texter saying, you know, I've got this little dark nook and cranny that I can't deal with a plant. There will be a plant that will grow in there, and it's registering those characteristics of that very particular place. And then, you know, I live in a place called Buninyong. Things will grow in Buninyong that we can't possibly grow here. And like,
wouldn't it be interesting? We often speak about what's the role of local council and of your local council. You know, it's got to be more than rates and rubbish, surely. And I wonder, you know, we're talking about cuttings, and this is just like a really simple concept, but sometimes the simplest of ideas are the ones that generate the biggest of change. Imagine if you could just go to your local council and get free cuttings or whatever it is.
Well, there's a text from Caroline in Oakley. She says, "Hi, Rish, Bron and guest. The City of Monash has a great Gardening for Wildlife program and a free booklet for residents wanting to create greater biodiversity. They also have programs where residents can get help on creating gardens and free local Indigenous seedlings." So there you go.
Being able to have access to that information. The role of what and understanding what we plant and where we plant to prevent natural disaster. Is that something, Jock, that you can talk to? Is that something that you've looked into?
Well, look, I think that's a much bigger topic, but it does also come back to what we're discussing about our relationship with the world. So we know that the Australian continent was managed and cared for using fire as a tool of management and caring. So First Nations people did that for generations and generations and generations. So the idea of fire being a threat is something that we need. That's a value system in itself, and we need to rethink
that. Well, that's right. It's looking at where we build, right?
It's where we build. It's how we build, and how we carefully reduce. The idea of hazard reduction. How we reduce fuel loads, how we use fire far more constructively in a landscape that is dependent upon fire. It's part of the landscape.
Kylie says, "I've slowly collected native weeping grass and seed and replaced and replanted our lawn. It doesn't need much water, no fertiliser. The native birds love eating the seed. I don't need to mow and I just let it go to seed." So what have you been doing in your little patch? And what information, what education would you like to try and promote more biodiversity in your home?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Are you rethinking lawn and are you thinking more natives? Are you trying to find ways to increase the biodiversity in your little patch of grass? No matter how small that is, it could be a balcony or you could have acres and acres. Our number's 1300 222 774. Rochelle Hunt and Bronwyn O'Shea with you. Dr. Jock Gilbert, landscape architect and lecturer at RMIT in the studio as well.
Now, somebody who has not only done this herself, replaced lawn with productive and native garden, but tells people how to do it as well, is Chloe Thompson. She's a horticulturalist, a garden coach, a regular contributor to Gardening Mags, and the founder of Sprout School. Hi, Chloe.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Good. Is it time we just gave up this obsession with lawns and did something different?
Look, I am a big fan of having a little bit of lawn. I probably have the world's smallest lawn. It's only 9 or 10 square metres. But, you know, reducing the amount of lawn that we have, as you guys have already talked about, and introducing some garden space is an absolute must. And, you know, I'm finding that from people who come to me for Sprout School. They've got, you know, like a great big rectangular backyard that's just a great big patch of lawn, sometimes a very miserable patch. And they're like, well, you know, where do I put plants? How do I put plants? Where do I start? So that's what people are wanting.
And where do you start? That's a really great question.
I mean, I love that you're a garden coach.
Yes. Well, it all happened because of lockdown and my inbox blew up with people asking what to plant where. But look, if you're wanting to rip up your lawn and plant more natives, or just plant more plants that aren't just pure lawn, then you guys have already talked about, you know, doing your research. But I'm a big fan of the neighbourhood snoop. So, you know, have a wander around your neighbourhood, peer over the front fences, you know, have a chat to people, join your local garden club and just find out what works in your area. Ask at your local nursery. You'll be surprised at, you know, what works really well in your area might be something that you hadn't thought of. yeah, research is key.
Absolutely. I have a neighbour, she's probably listening to this, so if she is, Kath, good morning. She's in her mid-90s, has the best garden you could ever imagine. She is out in that garden, I reckon, not only every day, but multiple times a day, just doing little bits and pieces. Her knowledge of what works, her nature strip is just this hive of activity. It is just Beautiful. Spectacular. I mean, that is a gold mine to pick her brain on what to plant and what not to.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, look, once you've done your research, you know, people think, well, where do I start then? Well, you know, that's where you can get out a scrap piece of paper and start sketching what you might want. You know, you're going to turn that rectangle of lawn into, you know, a kidney-shaped small lawn with garden beds around the outside. Or do you want little islands of garden beds, you know, with a trampoline in one corner, some veggie beds over there, you know, a little lawn in the middle so the kids can play cricket or what have you. So, you know, start sketching some ideas. You don't need to be a garden designer to do that.
And Chloe, I've always found gardeners an incredibly generous bunch. You know, people want to share the things that have worked in their gardens, don't they? You know, whether it's cuttings or seed or all of those sorts of things. I know that I have been fortunate to have gorgeous friends just shower me with things from their own gardens, to the point that they come over now and I'm like, look what you helped me do. And there's just mini versions of their garden in mine. So I just feel as though if you ask, you might be surprised at what people will be willing to give you.
Yeah, 100%. And that's where the, you know, the local gardeners and your local garden nursery are a wealth of knowledge.
Lots of texts coming in. I've just been to an inspiring exhibition at the Grant Pavilion in Torquay to celebrate Reconciliation Week. They are displaying many Indigenous plants to encourage native gardens. It was inspiring, says Christine. And Andrew says, no grow lawns. Mowing is good for your soul. I mow big lawns and parks every day. It's good for your mind. Few people have talked about the mental health benefits of a lawn.
I love that. Thank you so much for your time. And I'm glad that out of lockdown that something beautiful like a garden coach is what came from it. Chloe, thank you. I want to squeeze in Ivan, who's in Ballarat. Good morning. What did you want to share today?
In addition to there's been a lot of talk about plants and trying to improve biodiversity. What needs to be added in, I think, are logs, rocks, mulch. So you get those little critters, you're encouraging mycelium, you're improving the health of your soil so that everything you put into it is going to perform better and grow better for you. And it's also habitat.
I like that idea. Lots of nodding from you there, Jock. My first thought, though, when I think about logs and rocks is snakes. And
they're everywhere, Rochelle.
I know.
You've got to let it go.
I do have to let it go, don't I, Jock? Is that something you live in Australia, mate, get over it. They're going to be there.
They're all part of the living world, as Damon was saying. And Ivan, I think that's a great point, because I do think that we need to expand beyond the idea of the living and to incorporate the non-living. And that then brings us into touch with the idea of time. And, you know, things do rot. And so, yes, a plant might go to seed and not look very good at this point. But, you know, if it drops, you know, if something drops a branch, leave the branch there, let it rot down. That becomes part of the ecosystem as well. There's hundreds of millions of little fungi that will grow in there, and there'll be spiders and all that kind of thing. I mean,
Just wear gloves, right?
let's just go into the statistics of how many people die of snake bite in, you know, suburban Melbourne every year, and I think we probably lose more to cars and, you know, things like that. So it is all in perspective. We have a terrible fear of snakes and spiders, but
it's part of the garden.
So. I think,
it's funny, you know, we've spoken a lot today about neighbours and the role that it plays in connection, and that's such a big part of it. And I guess on a strange flip side, there's something quite sweet and then there's something quite strange about, so if you're out mowing your nature strip and our neighbour, bless the other neighbour, mowed our nature strip for us once, we're like, oh my God, is that just not the sweetest thing ever? And then next time we mowed their nature strip. But then I saw someone down the street when I was going for an evening walk the other day who mowed their patch and then stopped really distinctly, right?
Yes.
As if I'm not mowing 1 inch over
such
this.
Such a power move, isn't it?
So I went from flat to, and I don't know, I just think that neighbourly connection with gardens and lawns and clippings, and do you mow your neighbour's nature strip or not?
Yeah, look, and I think once gardens get a little bit more developed, I mean, we've got some really great little stands outside people's houses where, you know, whatever's in season. So there might be some daffodil bulbs, there might be some lemons, there might be some bunches of thyme, some bunches of silver beet. So the sharing kind of goes on, and I think sharing labour is a good thing. I mean, do we all really need a mower? Could we have a street mower?
You know, things
like that. So
yes, tool libraries, they talk about those, don't they?
That's my light bulb moment for today. A street mower.
Amy at Doncaster East, I think, has my light bulb moment of today, Rochelle. She says, I agree, native gardens are beautiful and we really need to change our perception of beautiful. Mm. She says, when I wake up to the sound of birds outside my windows, the sounds are beautiful. Going out to see the bees, the butterflies, the little birds enjoying our Indigenous garden, that to me is beautiful. School education about biodiversity and conservation is critical to make this change effective.
Dr. Jock Gilbert, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. It's been fascinating. So thanks for making the trip down.
Thanks, Rochelle. It's been great fun.
Dr. Jock Gilbert, landscape architect and lecturer at RMIT. And I would say by the end of the show, yes, absolutely, a lawn expert. You've got good neighbours, Bron, giving you lots of clippings.
I have beautiful friends and neighbours, very lucky.
Oh, no, you're going to have to hand some of those over. Have one of those little stalls out there. Not your friends, yes. The clippings.
Happy to share my friends too.
Don't forget, The Conversation Hour is a podcast. Go to the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.